Okay, we'll get started. I'm Tom Bracken, and the topic today is walking through the valley together, helping our friends, family, and patients with cancer. And let's just start with a moment of prayer. Lord, we thank you for gathering us together, but please bless our minds and hearts as we talk about this subject that too often hits us and our families. Amen. I was thinking about this the last few days. I've been a little overwhelmed by just the despair of the topics we've talked about. And they seem so deep and dark, and they're so big and international. We have the Lost Boys of Sudan. Heard that story twice, and it's just unbelievable. I didn't even know about it. Everybody knows about the Holocaust, and Bob did such an interesting job of putting us right in the Holocaust. Then we had Paul dramatically reading about lynchings in the South. And then I think the one that hit me the hardest was realizing there's still stonings in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And all these just horrific things. But then you can think, yeah, well, we don't have to deal with that. But, and those are really hells. That's a place that would be like living hell, to be in those situations. And I would imagine a great deal of those people are hopeless. And both Paul and Bob talked about ways to not be hopeless. Paul said that Richard Wright wrote those stories just so we would say we're not going to stand for that. And Bob Sorensen showed us how Viktor Frankl in the Holocaust kept his hope and kept some sense of love and awe. But a hell that we could face, in fact, most of us probably have, is that of cancer. And that's a reality that will hit us. One thing I wanted to do right at the beginning is just ask how many of you have had a close family member die of cancer? Boy, look at that. Almost everybody. How many, keep your hand up, how many more than have had a close friend die of cancer? And then how many more have had a loved one die of cancer? That's just about everybody. Okay, this is my fifth time at Holden. Every time gets better. Third time on teaching staff. And I learned something in 2001. The theme was, I have called you by name. And Bob was talking about that in a sense an hour ago. That's from the Bible somewhere. I think it's in the Psalms. And it means that everyone is loved by God. Well, gosh, just about anybody religion would check true to that. In any religion, Hindu or whatever. But it really imprinted itself in my heart that year, and I learned that everyone's precious in God's sight. And boy, that changes how you treat somebody. You know, the person that cuts you off in traffic, if you really think their preciousness is in God's sight, you're probably not going to do any road rage. Everything I talk about at Holden pretty much is based on either mostly personal struggle. Luckily, we're done with the sex classes. I've been a family doctor for 30 years, and I have a list here of 110 patients that I took care of with terminal cancer. Doesn't mean I did a lot, but I kept track. This is the last 10 years. I don't know how many years have been in 30. There's been more in the last 10. But the thing that really made a difference for me was that my mother died of colon cancer 17 years ago. And I very vividly remember my dad calling me and telling me, and he stumbled over the words, that mom has metastatic cancer. He didn't know what it meant, but I knew what it meant. I meant my life changed. I know life is not going to be the same. And that, in my kind of sheltered upbringing, was the first time, I mean, grandma and grandpa died, but that was the first time when life's not going to be the same. We're not going to have Christmas dinners, and I'm going to have to go through this. Certainly not as bad for me as it was for her, but it was plenty bad. And just the fear was probably worst right then of the whole experience. And I debated whether to do this, but I have a picture of Mom and Dad. Dad's still living. And I'm talking about Dad next week, if you really want to hear about that. And height-wise, I'm exactly right here, right in between. My dad's 6'1". What's fair about that? Mom is not quite 5 feet. And I have a daughter that's 4'11 and a half. So this, they were in England maybe 5 years before Mom died. And it's, I was really surprised to look at this picture the other day. My cousin sent it to me on Facebook. And to see how Dad's smiling. He smiles a little bit like that, like at my grandson now, but that's about it. During the time we're here together today, I hope I don't get through my material. That means that you had more to say. So please don't hesitate to jump in. I'm not an educator, so if I'm not doing the overhead right or anything else right, let me know. Let's just talk about cancer itself a little bit. People have some misconceptions what cancer is. Cancer is not necessarily fast-growing tissue. It's tissue which grows without normal controls. Now, in some cases, like leukemia, it's growing very, very rapidly. The amount of the rate of the growth of leukemia is phenomenal, some other cancers. And actually, the cancers that are sometimes hardest to kill are the ones that are growing the slowest, because chemo works by kind of randomly, or it's not very discriminatory, it kills growing cells. So the growth then causes invasion of normal areas, and that can lead sometimes to spreading distantly. So you hear people that have benign brain tumors, you think, well, that's not so bad. Well, it's kind of hard to get in the brain, and there's places you can't get at all. And even though they're not a cancer, they can kill you. And then there's other cancers that really are no big deal. We just take care of them, and people will die from them. So one out of 200 Americans are diagnosed with cancer each year. So three people here. I think of the size of the village, three people in any community this size will get diagnosed. Now that includes some benign skin cancers and also some nasty things. 25% of Americans die from cancer. That's certainly not true in Sudan or some of the places they've been talking about in the third world, because they just don't live long enough. Some of our cancers are environmental that our ancestors wouldn't have gotten. What's the main environmental thing? It's one thing.
Pollution.
No.
Smoking.
Oh.
We doctors preach to people, did you count what percentage of trans fats you just had, and worry about radon and all these things, but there's one thing we should quit preaching about, all the other stuff. Maybe you leave alcohol in there as far as driving, and it's smoking. Smoking is, people just don't get it. It's terrible, and it just drives me nuts when I have a patient. We get them through heart attack, I'm all nervous about it, and they just about die in the helicopter, and they come back, and how are you doing smoking? Pretty good. I just hate that. So here's my terminal cancer patients. I've got their name. I started doing this 10 years ago. I don't remember why. Their name, what kind of cancer they had, and how long they survived, and how much I had to do with it. And I've kept track, and I've got 36 from lung cancer. The next is colon with 19, prostate 18, breast 4, and those are the only ones that had big numbers like that. And then just a smattering of all sorts of other kinds of things. So by far it was lung. And 4 out of 5 lung cancers are caused by smoking. And the people you really want to slap are the ones that say, oh, I've smoked for 50 years and I'm fine. And the guy next door to me and the nervous smoke died of lung cancer. Well, 1 out of 5 lung cancers are not from smoking. Whoever said environment, they're right. It does cause some cancer, but not near as much as smoking.
Would the lung cancer of the non-smoker be secondhand smoke?
Some of them, but some of them just happen. Our bodies, we actually probably all get cancer, but we have, you've heard of T cells with AIDS, and Jenny, you should sit right here.
I was doing garbology, or I would not have been late to talk.
And I was
but
once...
I changed clothes and walked in. I didn't take time for the shower, because I was trying to get here.
I was once the assistant to the garbologist, but I, as of this week, been demoted to the former assistant to the former garbologist.
And you're okay with that?
I'm not okay with that. It hurts my feelings.
Tom, you're on the smoking kick, and you know me fairly well.
I think I do, yeah.
I've stopped many times. I've stopped for the last 2 weeks. The battle is that the first 7-Eleven or Circle K that I drive by, there's going to be a heck of a disturbance in my van.
Yeah.
My wife and my granddaughter will possibly kill me if I step out of the van. Why am I so ignorant?
People have been asking that question, Fred.
Yeah.
You know, it's a more powerful physical addiction than alcohol or sex or the other things. I've had friends that have had a couple of addictions and conquered them and have not been able to quit smoking. Part of it is, if you go back to AA philosophy, it doesn't make your life unmanageable at the time, so you're not as compelled to quit. It doesn't make you hit rock bottom unless it kills you.
Unless you have COPD and can't go up the mountain anymore. That bothers me.
So that's part of it. But the other thing, the other answer I gave you, Fred, is the people that quit are often the ones that have quit several times, and they finally do it. So rather than kicking yourself because, well, geez, I quit for 2 weeks again, I'm not going to quit this time, why don't you congratulate yourself? I got another 2 weeks and I'm not smoking. And that's 2 weeks to the good.
Yeah.
So look at that. And if you slip and have one a while ago, just say, you know, I'm not a smoker.
Thank you.
Hope that helps. So I was just telling you about how hard it was with Mom when I first heard the news. And how do you hear it? Or maybe you know it. I have a patient my age that we just took a colon cancer out. She said, yeah, I knew it was there for 2 years. And she's stubborn. It took me 9 months to convince her to even have an exam. And often you feel something, we all do, you think, geez, I wonder if that's worrisome, and you show somebody or you hope it goes away, and it does, but it doesn't always go away. And I would guess most often it's in the family doctor's office or specialist office, phone, letter, email, text message. On the office, they were all waiting. How many people are Office fans? Oh, you are. God, yeah, my family. Kevin found out that his biopsy was negative, which got Michael Scott was all upset because negative seems like a bad word. He was very comforting, but he found out by phone. So, of course, we have phones more places than we used to. And as doctors, we do tests all the time, and you have to think as a doctor. I'll often say, you know, I'm going to have this test result on Wednesday. I want you to come and see me on Thursday. And none of you are likely to be my patient. So if I say that, I'm worried about the result. But I try to do that as often as possible because I don't want to call over the phone. And I lie. I try not to lie in my life, but I'll lie. Your results aren't back yet, but they're going to be back tomorrow. Let's get together and we can go through this. That means I already know. And they often know too. So it's a really tough thing to do. And for some of you that are health professionals, I think it's really important to have time and have the right people there and have privacy. Because most of them take it pretty matter of fact on the surface. But there are emergencies in life. One is if your teenager comes home and wants to talk to you. I had somebody the other day who's not here now and wanted to tell me that, let me make sure he's not here, 21 years ago that day his son had been injured and I had something else to do here. Well, you've got to do that. It's the most important thing you'll do that day. People don't recognize that. They think, well, I got production I got to get done. I got to get to this meeting. I remember in med school there was a little baby dying of meningitis. And the priest came and visited for 5 minutes, and he said, you know, I really got to get to a meeting. And I thought, gosh, what? And the parents were just They're very simple people, and they said, oh, thank you so much for coming, but it was the most important thing he probably could have done that year, and he left. So you have to have lots of time, and it's really helpful if you can get the right people there. It depends on how important it is. You tell someone they have a skin cancer take off, no big deal, but tell them their cancer's back and it's bad, stuff like that is really important. Do you have any thoughts on that, Jane?
Just about the priest. Just because a person is a pastor or a priest doesn't mean they know how to do a good job when it comes to people who are sick. And it seems like many people in my profession, I'd say more of parish priests or pastors, they'll come in, and especially if it's a liturgical denomination, they'll just read a prayer, and then they've done their thing, or they bless them with oil, and they've done their thing, but they don't know how to say, you know, tell me how you're doing with this, and let them talk and share. And I think the older the pastor or priest, sometimes the worst they're going to be, because they didn't have a thing called clinical pastoral education where you learn how to do that. And some people just hate hospitals. They became a priest or a pastor, but they love the pulpit, but they hate hospitals and they hate illnesses. So, but you're right, that was awful of that priest.
I think that those things that you said that the parish minister should do mostly end up to listening. Mm-hmm. And there's you don't have to give them a bunch of platitudes. God will see you through. We're going to pray for healing. No, you just listen.
Tom.
Yeah.
This lady here.
Do you give benign results
with them? It's benign.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, because I want them to know really. And I have to, when I call, hi.
What was the question? What was the question?
Do you give benign results over the phone? I'll say, I've got good news. Say, oh, how are you? How's the weather? Well, it could be getting cloudy. You know, there could be difficult times ahead. No, I got good news.
So they know if they're getting called in, it's probably not good.
It's worse when it's a surprise. You said, I don't think there's anything wrong here. And you do a CT, which is how we diagnose this stuff all the time now. And you weren't suspecting it. And that happens once in a while.
Yeah.
Not too often, but once in a while. Oh my! And you have to be creative, and sometimes talk to my partners or somebody that's around and try to get an answer. How am I going to get this done? This is going to be tough. So another thing I do, and my kids would testify to this: you write out some of the information because they're not going to hear anything. You say, I'm sorry, but you've got cancer. And at some point, you say, we can fight this. We're going to make some progress. But it's spread to your bones and your adrenal glands and your brain. And boy, they didn't hear much after that first sentence. So I have a treatment. I have exactly what the words mean. Try to have it in. I have to think of what their literacy level is, and it's different for a college professor or than it is for a younger person. And I have what the next step is, what their tests are, and what the treatment plan is. Now, you can go too far with this, but you at least have to have, what's next? Mm-hmm. What are we going to do? And it's a lot of work. I showed you this list, and there wasn't a lot of sitting by the bedside holding hands with this list and with the people that maybe were grateful for what I did or didn't do. But there was a lot of getting stuff together that took a lot of time. So I won't give too much information. It's too much to cope with. And I tell them the initial plan of evaluation and treatment. So they need to know their basic options. And some of them are content with that, and some of them aren't. And they often have choices. Sometimes they don't. I guess everybody has a choice. If nothing else, they have the choice of alternative therapy. Going to Mexico or in Minnesota, should I go to Mayo? Mm-hmm. Is a question we get asked. I was asked last week, last time I worked. So that's what happens when you face the first news.
Do you find that some of us, when we talk to a doctor and something is amiss, that we run to the internet?
Oh, my, yes.
Is that helpful? Or is
that's,
it just,
I think it's 98% helpful. It's a little bit when they come in with some goofy thing that they found somewhere, but it's easier to deal with educated people. Now, some people are just mean-spirited people, and they want to have one over on you. You know, they've looked up something.
I don't know
my doctor. Yeah, they want to say, well, yeah, 2% chance of that. You didn't think of that, did you? I had that experience right before I came to Holden this week.
We were told not to until our entire plan was set out. We were told not to.
By your doctor? Hmm. That'd be hard to do.
Well, we had meetings every single day with doctors, and they were pretty good.
What kind of a cancer was it?
Lung cancer.
Yeah. And there are unreliable things on the internet. Most of us, if you're careful, you can figure that out. You had a question there?
I'm a veterinarian, so I have patients with cancer frequently as well, but it's a little bit different.
You write out a plan of action for them.
I do. I do chemo. Mm-hmm. And,
well, I was teasing it. It was supposed to be a joke about the animals.
But what I do is I give them websites I want them to read so that they get the good information first. And I know they're going to do more research after that, but hopefully they mined the appropriate sources first. But one of the experiences that I had, and I don't know if this applies to people, because in my family, everybody drops dead of cancer. I've never had anybody, heart attack. I've never had any cancer at all yet. But when it brings up other deaths, unresolved issues, and I see that time and time and time again, and we get no training in vet school on how to deal with that, and it's just something that I've developed over 15 years of practice. But
what do you mean it brings up unresolved issues?
Their father just died, their mother died.
Oh, now we've got another loss.
Other losses that they've somehow buried or thought they had dealt with, they start bubbling up, especially people that are alone. Does that happen with your families?
That's their last friend.
Sometimes. Do you, when you're dealing with the family of the patient, do you see that?
I'm just looking if I mentioned it here. All the time. You know, one thing, the relationship with me, is it trusting or non-trusting? Have their relationship with medicine, have they kind of had good experiences or bad? I'm not going to get too personal, but I took care of Paul's parents. That was the easiest thing in the world to do. That there was never one moment that wasn't just easy and a blessing. And then other people, like, you feel like you've been cursed. And, you know, of course, me as physicians, say, I'll take her if you'll take him.
Yeah.
I did that last week. Because some people are just, you know, they're just never satisfied with anything.
Do you see other losses coming up?
Oh, my, yes. Yeah. And some people have had too many losses.
Yeah.
Somebody was telling me this week about, it was Bob. He told all of us about how his mother lost her husband and then the next year lost her son to a brain tumor. How can you do that?
That's when you call the chaplain.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally serious. And especially if they're an inpatient, because they absolutely positively have to talk about all of those things and just get it out, and you listen and you listen and you listen. If it's appropriate, and there's deaths that they haven't dealt with, to send them to a grief counselor or a grief group.
I've had to do
that. But they need to talk, because they have to sort all that out, too.
We were offered right away cancer counselors.
Yeah.
And we used them, but still didn't.
Bigger community?
Minneapolis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which hospital were you working with?
We were working with Methodist.
Yeah.
They have a
great. Who's your oncologist?
Dr. Carlson.
Oh. Oh, yeah. Dr. Dwayne was a good friend of mine. He's an oncologist.
We had Dr. Dwayne several times.
And in a small place, we don't have that stuff. We have a 20-bed hospital. You know, we have to do it all.
I often call,
Jenny, I'm totally disoriented. Who's my chaplain? Oh, Joe, yeah, he gets very involved, yeah. Very ecumenical. Bill?
You know, this last several years, my family's been just immersed in cancer and the problems that occurred. And I appreciated one doctor who asked my brother and me to come down to give this news of a melanoma to my mother. And I was so struck because he said, you know, Bill, and this is some family doctor, kind of like you are, that goes all the way back to the 50s, the family. This was the son of our regular family doctor.
Oh, really?
And he just did, he said, I'm glad that you came because I just didn't know what I was going to say to your mother.
Yeah.
And I that really made me appreciate how difficult it is for doctors as well as it is for patients. It's not just the turmoil that we as family, but the doctors who have grown close to their patients with a history of 50 years.
So he showed some vulnerability and some humanity to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Bob Sorensen the other day said when he has a doctor, he likes a doctor that treats him as a thou, mm-hmm. but he wants to make sure he knows about the it, too. He doesn't want a doctor that just treats him as a thou. We do see that. I have teach family practice residents. We occasionally see them that can't get beyond that. You have to be a good doctor as well. But that helped, and he was smart enough to know that he needed some help.
Yeah.
And Jeannie, I have more often than the chaplain I call their old pastor. Of course, you have to get permission now to do that. But there's ways around that, too.
Even in a small town, you can call hospice. And hospice always has a chaplain.
We have hospice now, which has helped a lot. So you're talking about coping, and Conrad Ryan, wasn't he a novelist, said the diagnosis changes everything, and just like that, your life is different. Because I can die with this. So how you cope with this, how you react, influences your course of evaluation treatment. But attitude isn't everything. You know, there's science, there's reality, and it can be bolstered by the physicians, family, and caregivers. So some of the stages we see are denial and disbelief. Kubler-Ross talked a lot about that. I see it more with terminal than I do with I have a cancer. And actually, when you talk about addiction to people, you tell them you have this diagnosis of an addiction, and they'll deny they have that and don't want to deal with it. And I always say, well, if you had cancer, you'd deal with it. And actually, most of us do. We want to live. Turmoil. And we've all, most of us, grieved a loss of someone, and you can't think straight. When my mom died, we were building a house, and they're asking me questions. I couldn't decide between door A and door B. Actually, what happened was they put up a cheap door, and I'd say, that's fine. They put up a more expensive door, and Sue would say, well, that more expensive one is nicer, and they go, okay, the more expensive one. And you move on to treatment. So what kind of attitude do you bring? And you were talking there, you know, maybe you've had a lot of losses. Maybe you are distrustful. Maybe you're very trustful. You really trust your physician. Boy, does that make things easier. And I've had people like that. What do you really think, doctor? What would you do? Or what do I hear more often than what would you do?
What would you do if it was your mom?
What would you do if it was your mom? I hear that all the time. That really helps that I feel like they trust me and I'm going to be able to give them some good advice. And however you react to stress, I talked about state-dependent learning in the sex classes, and most of us have ways that we react to stress, and according to, I think it was Adler, it's how we react to things when we were four. All that stuff is established by the time you go to school. And maybe you recognize that. Three myths to recognizing cancer. Number one, I don't see this too often. You wanted cancer. Maybe some of my hypochondriacs. Your problems cause cancer, or your negative attitude is aiding your cancer. I'm going to get into detail on that a little bit. I must be done with that page.
They wanted to be done with you.
One of my worst experiences with death was my brother who had Lou Gehrig's disease.
Ooh, oh, that's a tough one.
That was the worst thing. I mean, we've had other people in family die, many people already died. That was one of the worst deaths our family ever suffered.
Yeah.
We all suffered. The wife, the
children. There's ways to make it better. I think we do better. I've had, I think, four patients die of that. They all did pretty good.
He became mean at first through the denial.
Really? that's the same as cancer. I mean, it's inevitable, and it's not painful, but it's going to happen, and there's nothing you can do about it.
It was,
the medicine doesn't work.
A lot of prayers to the family.
So how do we cope? Well, what factors aid coping? Positive attitude and optimism help. I'm going to go out and do something about it. Negative attitude and pessimism don't help, but chemo works the same. Surgery works just about as well. Day at a time is a lot better than working excessively about the future. Remind me of that when I get it. You meet the crisis head on rather than someone that avoids all challenges. I've got patients that would never meet a challenge. If you're overly stressed to begin with, although sometimes it helps you focus. And when my mom died, she had an anxiety disorder to the point that if she was in this building, she might worry that ceiling was going to come down. She quit worrying about stupid things and just worried about the real thing. I think more importantly is if you're informed, it's better than if you're uninformed. Supportive doctor and team versus an unsupportive doctor and team. And it really depends again. I mean, skin cancer is not a big deal. Well, you got leukemia, you're going to get into a team. We have an ongoing situation in my hometown where I got bracelet on. I think my wife does too. Last time I was in Holden, as I came out, I found out that my partner's, 18-year-old daughter had a mass in her belly. Make a long story short, she's got a neuroblastoma and it has metastasized by the time it was found. And she's a perfect kid. She's never done anything wrong. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to list her shortcomings, you couldn't do it. And she was in excellent physical shape. And they have a team down at the university with a doctor who happens to be a staunch Lutheran, they found out just recently, who has just seen them through this incredible torture that she's gone through. She's now been in the hospital for 3 months. I think went outside of a hospital room for the first time in 3 months last week. Mm-hmm. Yeah. On the other hand, I have another friend that had cancer. She has breast cancer. And I went to the first meeting with our local cancer doctor, and he was an hour late and didn't realize he was going to see her, and he hadn't read her chart.
Ooh.
And he's a good cancer doctor, but he's a little odd. He's not somebody you just immediately warm to. I mean, who would walk up to Bob Sorensen and say, boy, I'm not going to like him? And some people would walk up to this person. Other people really like him, but he's eccentric. And it just didn't work. And they wanted to stay local, but they said, you know, this isn't going to work for us. It's too important. So they went out somewhere else and found a team of doctors they really like. And even if they've been your family doctor for 50 years, you have to find people they help you through. And in our practice, some people do a better job of this than others, and people generally find the people they like. I've really had trouble with patients that are stuck with doctors they don't like and they won't switch. Mm-hmm. I got into big trouble over that once, trying to encourage them to leave. Same thing, of course, goes with family and friends. And usually you find that they're supportive. Now, occasionally, people are just so afraid that they pull away. We've all seen that happen. How about faith? I'm not saying you have to be a Christian. I'm not saying you have to be religious, but a belief system, a faith system. You've helped a lot of people. Jenny, what would you say?
I'd say that people who have faith seem to have more hope, because whether they live or whether they die, they have something to hold on to. So I'd say it's the what's interesting is that people who have never been, you know, church-going or religious, if their cancer gets bad, they often revert to the faith of their childhood. I was working with an AIDS patient who, motorcycle, drinking, tattooed, I mean, all the stereotypes of bad language, never been darkened the door, I thought, of the church. But one day he said to me, "Jeannie, do you know how I cope when the pain gets too bad?" And I said, "No," I thought he'd say street drugs, because I thought he'd have them brought in. And there was a cross on the end of his room, on the wall, with an outstretched arms of Jesus. And he said, I turned to him, and I said, "I didn't know you knew him." And he said, "I went to Sunday school as a kid. When the pain gets too bad, I talk to him, and he helps me through it." So faith is, you know, whether you have to dig back into the roots of your childhood, faith comes bubbling up and gives people strength. So I find that they do a lot better with some form of faith.
You mentioned the word hope, and there's a book by Dr. Sherwin Nuland. I think it's in the library. It's either in the library or in the bookstore. And he just talks about how people die. We ultimately die because our brain doesn't get oxygen. But there's a chapter in there, Hope in the Cancer Patient, and his brother had cancer. Now, Dr. Nuland's a surgeon at Yale. And throughout his cancer, which was colon cancer that spread, they kept trying things. They said, we were pretty hopeful that the cancer treatment was going to do it. What they never told him was that he was dying. And from the beginning to the end, his hope was that they're going to save my life. And the last thing that Dr. Nuland saw of his brother was going off to another procedure, I think which killed him, and the desperate look in his brother's face. And he said, the real hope is not that there's a slight chance you're going to survive, it's that you're going to make peace with yourself, your family, God, come to terms with life. And so they say that doctors should never give up hope. But I do give up hope of people surviving, because I know they won't. None of us leave this place alive that I've seen yet. And then counseling and pastoral counseling and hospice is excellent for this. Any other thoughts on this? Go ahead.
At the top of the list, you talked about attitude. My husband's father died of lung cancer shortly before I met him. And when people, especially early, you know, not too long after his father's death, when people would talk about other people who are very sick or with cancer and the importance of a positive attitude,
mm-hmm.
I would see my husband physically bristle, because I think this felt like if his dad had only had a better attitude, mm-hmm. maybe he would have had a better outcome. Mm-hmm. And how do you sort of balance that message of encouraging a positive attitude but not doing it in a way that people feel like somehow this is their fault, mm-hmm. or they're not getting a good outcome because their attitude isn't quite right?
Could you come up to Schley 10 afterwards? I got a piece of pie for you.
Mm-hmm.
I did not set that up, folks. The tyranny of positive thinking. Some studies have suggested that patients with positive attitudes have improved survival rates. Therefore, it is imperative to have a positive attitude or you will die. That's like not thinking about elephants, isn't it? Some scripture says to believe you will receive what you pray for as if you have already received it. So if you falter your faith, again, you will die. And the people that go to faith healings that aren't healed, it's an unconfessed sin. So there's those same myths that we talked about before. There was a Tribune article, Star Tribune in Minneapolis article about cancer being a gift from God. Well, and Alan Story talks about this in his lectures that I outfit everybody on yesterday, that those things are not gifts from God. God can give you gifts through them. We had several gifts in my family from my mom dying of cancer, mostly my sister reconciling herself to her mother and to the rest of us, but the cancer itself is not a gift. And the truth is, the studies about positive attitudes showed a relatively weak effect at most. Studies really haven't held up. Patients with more positive attitudes probably had less worrisome disease. And cancer is tissue that doesn't respond to hormones. That's the whole problem. It's not responding to the regular hormones it's supposed to be responding to. So it won't respond to your attitude the way that other healthy tissue might. They've done studies on grieving sad people, and they don't get cancer more often. And the mind does affect hormone levels, but it's not clear that those hormone levels affect cancer. But good support helps people live longer and live better. So I would, if I could be a priest and forgive your loved one that died of cancer, they did not die because they had a bad attitude. Unless, I mean, if they turned out you'd see people turn down treatments that shouldn't turn down. Not very often. More often you see people not turn down treatments they should turn down. So suggestions with attitude. You can help yourself by having healthy habits. Don't blame yourself. Negativity doesn't cause cancer. decide what you believe, consider alternatives. You use a coping style that works for you. Emotions don't make your cancer recurse or spread. There's a lot of this met my partner's daughter, his husband and wife, and the mom does a lot of mental imagery of getting the white cells to increase. Mm-hmm. They have to wait for this bone marrow transplant to work. And she sings songs to the white cells. What was the song she was singing?
Oh, I can't remember.
She was singing a song to the white cells, mm-hmm. make them increase, and they rang up the next day. And support groups are helpful, and hospitals will do that. Now, the support groups are not always lasting very long, because people die. Now I screwed up my order. Okay. So I think a big part of the key is to connect with a doctor or other caregiver that you can talk comfortably and honestly. Get back to Mom. Mom was diagnosed with metastatic cancer. One of the first things they did was a barium enema. We don't do much. She came in the hospital to have that done, just walked in, and she was all dehydrated, and she collapsed in the hall outside the hospital x-ray room, and my dad was pleading, somebody help me. People walked by him. I just can't believe this happened. It's a good hospital. It's right by our hometown. Well, they got her in. They got it done. The next thing that I couldn't believe, which not had happened in Mille Lacs Hospital, was they sent her home. Geez, somebody collapses and they need help and they can't walk. They put them in the hospital. Well, it's a city hospital and they don't generally do that. Nobody really cared about her much. Well, then they called her that night and said, oh, you've got cancer in your colon. You need to come back.
Oh,
but she already knew she had cancer. She just didn't know which one, but she had to come back. And that led to surgery. I never got involved in the decision process. You know, if I have patients, I usually get to know who they are, and if they have physicians as family, I find a way to talk to them. You just have to. I wasn't terribly angry about this. I was a little surprised. And so she's recovering from surgery in the hospital. And my dad knew if he got at the hospital at 6 in the morning, he might be able to talk to the doctor. The doctor never sat down with me, and Dad just didn't know how to handle these problems. She went home, recovered from the surgery, went home, and went through a bunch of chemo, which in her case didn't help. And things were getting worse and worse. I talked to Dad probably every other day or so, which was more, we would go 3 months without speaking prior to that. Not because we hated each other, it's just family style. And he just had no idea where to turn. Well, how about to your son that's a family doctor? He didn't think of that.
You're still a kid.
Yeah, well, come to the dementia talks. You were always a kid. And finally he found out they had visiting nurses. And the visiting nurses got involved. Mom was having trouble with pain. She wasn't keeping the pain meds down. And finally, one day, it was a crisis, and he called them, and they admitted her to the hospital, thank heavens. And from then on, he had communication, at least with nurses. And the nurses are more important, by the way. Mm-hmm. And she had pain relief, and that was really the end of her intense suffering. But it made me determined not to do this with my patients, that I did not have. So coping is always easier when you have someone who will face your fears with you. Your doctor, your family, friends, pastor, Jesus, God, Allah, somebody. Ron was talking earlier this week about when you look at communities, you should look at not the problems they have, but the strengths they have. Mm-hmm. That's the way to start looking for solutions. And you need to look at what strengths your family already have. Well, we had monetary strengths. We loved each other. Communication wasn't hot. And it's crucial to look at that. What kind of support are they going to have? What kind of support are they not going to have? When I look at these groups, one of the things I wrote at the end was, out of 1 to 5 scale, how much did I help? Bill, with his myeloma, I helped 5 out of 5, even though they had a fairly good support system. Don, you know, I love Don, and actually Don, and I don't know if anybody's met Jim Rison that's been here. Jim was his pastor and was with that family 100% of the way. Their support was really their family pastor. So identify your problems. Keep a notebook. People don't do that. They don't come in with their transplant patients do, and diabetics sometimes, they keep a notebook of what's going on. Decide how much information you want and need, and how much of a partnership you want with your doctor. Now, in some of these cases, they want to be there all the way. Others, we really don't need you. We have the big state university, whatever. And if you don't have a spouse, have a medical companion. My friend with breast cancer had a number of friends that drove with her to every radiation treatment. She's not terribly ill, but it was just not so lonely then. And consider a second opinion, and I encourage them all the time, sometimes third and fourth. And you have to know how to reach your doctors. One thing, of course, we have cell phones now. And one thing I do with something that's this serious, I immediately give my home number. We're not listed in the phone book. I don't want people calling me day and night. But my most problematic patient, it's not cancer, but an equally serious problem, called me at 4 in the morning the other day. And I tell him I won't always be there. I can't come into the hospital for you. But I'll answer questions. And you have at least one person that knows what's going on, and I can call your whoever is taking care of you. I can call them and tell them what's going on so you're not just feeling abandoned. And figure out which families are going to be involved. You know, I have one sister that's out of state. She can't help. And I always, when I take care of these people, I get the names and numbers of people besides the identified one because I may need to talk to them in the middle of the night sometime.
How are the new HIPAA laws affecting your abilities?
You know, they only, almost everybody lets you do it. You just have to ask. And when it's important, I ignore them. I told our pastor about 3 months ago, you got to quit looking at me in church when you say, I'm not sure how so-and-so is in the hospital. I can't tell you. She would say, well, you know, Bill's in the hospital. I think he's better from the stroke. Right, Tom? As if I could just tell her. So, and especially with people that are losing competence, that's more true with dementia, but it's also true with cancer. There's a point, maybe you're drugged up or ill or whatever, you're losing competence. I just take the step forward and go ahead, sue me. It's more important than the HIPAA laws, but I try not to break HIPAA laws. HIPAA, for those of you who don't know it, is it's basically the rule that a lot of ramifications that you have to respect a patient's privacy. So, I mean, I didn't mention any last names of the patients I was talking about here, except for my parents. I'm going to play a song for you, which I'm also going to play during the dementia time next week. Everybody distracted me with clever things before we got started. I don't have it all ready to go. Talk about something.
This is a great album.
I guess I wanted to make a comment. My mother had, by the time they discovered her liver cancer, she went into hospice. And as soon as she was settled, her faith was so strong, she just laid down and she said, I'm ready for the Lord to take me. And that is such a comfort to the family when the patient is so accepting. The other comment I want to make was about listening skills. I'm going to do my little promo for Stephen Ministry.
It's I heard a that listening word. I heard that another time when I was here.
And that's what we do. Pastors and so on are so bogged down with the duties. We're a group that listens. And I encourage all churches to go online to Stephen Ministry and find out. You get training. It's confidential. We deal one-on-one, and we do nothing but listen. We don't solve your problem. We don't. We just listen.
I second the Stephen Ministry. Mm-hmm. Very much so.
We had Stephen Ministries when we were adopting, and the birth mom was wavering, and it was wonderful.
Oh, boy. That might be tough.
In some hospitals, there are befrienders also. Yeah. And we have a huge befriender program that's gone on for 44 years, mm-hmm. and confidentiality and so on. So
Bono, his real name is Paul Hewson, I think.
Hewson.
Hewson?
Hewson.
His father was dying of cancer, and he was a surly old guy. And Bono was sitting in one of the hospital, and this is what came. came out of that.
That's not it.
Well, not that.
Give track three.
Is that your father's music?
There you go.
And this song won a Grammy Award. Best rock song of the year.
Can you guys hear it?
You think you got the stuff? You're telling me and anyone your heart enough. You don't have to put up a fight. You don't have to always be right. Let me taste some of the punches for you tonight.
Interesting for me and how it applies in my family to the dementia that my ads, basically. Well, we're at the end of the time. I'll be here if people have questions. Thank
can
you.
I just say one thing?
You can say two things.
There you go. I think one of the most important things that I, as a chaplain, have learned is that, as like you said over here, is listening to people and not fixing it. Because I think when we're involved with our own family members, as a professional, we can stand back. Especially when we're involved with our own family members, what I find is family members have a tendency to tell the patient what they should do. You should do this, you should do this, and the patient shouldn't lose their autonomy and decision-making power and should be the one that, you know, we say, for example, I'll say to someone, you know, how are you handling this, or what is your plan, or if they're dying, what do you need to die peacefully, or whatever. And I remember I had a lady, she said, she was just so angry, and she said, my kids are telling me this, and one kid said, and I said, well, tell me about your life, you know, tell me about who you are. And as she told her story, she got to the part where she said, my daughter is getting married in July, this is in December. Mm. And she said, I want to get that wedding, don't I? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, do you? And she said, well, yes, I do. I guess I'm going to take the treatment. So because they were all bombarding her about their opinion of what she should do, because we want to fix people we love, because we want them there. But she had to tell her story and unpackage all that to be able to come to the place where she knew what she wanted to do. So out of our love, we sometimes make it harder for the people we love instead of listening and just asking them questions to give them our own fix-it advice.
When my mom was diagnosed with liver cancer, it was just 4 months from diagnosis to death, but she was so angry. She was angry at the universe. This is not my plan. I'm 72. I've got lots I want to do. How can this be? So she didn't let any of her friends even come.
Did she stay that way?
She stayed that way to the end. But when I talked to her at the end, you know, she said, well, I'm ready to go, you know, and she'd had an experience, a very spiritual experience earlier in life when she had a heart attack. So she was very comfortable that she knew where she was going, but she was very angry that this wasn't her plan. And she was a control person. I mean, you know, she kept the world going.
That makes, well,
you die the way you live, you know, and if you're a control person and this is out of your control,
this is out of control.
We're all going to be angry if we get this diagnosis.
Yes.
Because some people are angry longer than others.
All right, thank you, everyone.
Thank you.